nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
Good morning, and good afternoon, rather, everyone. We're delighted that you're here for this important seminar today. We have a special guest with us, an old friend of mine. You look at us both and probably couldn't imagine that we were students at one stage, but we were. And we were both classmates at Princeton. Dr. Chung was an outstanding student, made competition very tough for me. And the rest of his life has been the same. He's always been good at everything he's done. He went from Princeton to teach at the University of Wyoming in the faculty there. And while he was there, he worked with a man by the name of Barresi, and they wrote a beautiful book in advanced strength or elasticity, kind of the intersection of that subject. And I use it frequently. Now he's revising it, writing other books. He's just extraordinarily productive. From Wyoming, he went to the National Science Foundation and became really the entrepreneur, the person who took the subject of solid mechanics and took it where it needed to go in terms of leading research in the country. Played a big role in changing the emphasis that we had from old-fashioned solid mechanics to the modern methods that he's going to talk about, I think, today. I am especially pleased that he's here and honored by his presence, and I'm very much looking forward to his presentation. Dr. Chung.
Thank you, Professor Pipes. Well, we were classmates many years ago, so I wouldn't say how long ago. But I was in Purdue about 30 years ago, and that's probably before a lot of you were here. So this is my second tour to Purdue, and I noticed so many changes. And so today I'm going to make an overview of some of those cutting-edge research, if I may, in different areas, basically in nano and biomechanics. Let's see.
Page down.
Okay. Yeah, this is my outline. I'll give you an introduction, a general introduction on where we are. And then I'll talk about translational research. What's the meaning of that? We have been talking about transformative research, transcendental technologies, and a lot of different things, but the latest one we'd like to emphasize is translational. And I'll give you some idea what's the meaning of that. Then I'll spend some time on the nanoscience and engineering, later on bioscience and engineering. And if we have time, we are limited to 1 hour, right? I'll talk something about multi-scale modeling, okay? If not, then we'll go into the summary. Oh, this one. This is the one. Okay, that two keys of the same thing. Not that one. Okay, I got it. Just to give you an idea where the National Science Foundation is, we are an independent agency, just like NASA and the EPA, and it reports directly to the president, so it doesn't belong to any department. In other countries, such as China or Europe, they usually belong to like a certain department. So we are an independent agency. When I first joined the foundation 21 years ago, our budget was $1.9 billion. Now the budget is $6.5 billion. So there's some increases, but it's not as much as we would like. This is the topography, if you will, of the 21st century. We have all these different types of parameters, if you like, that we look into. For example, the information explosion. In the past, we always say knowledge is power. But now we need to modify that a little bit. We have too much knowledge. So you need to know the right knowledge, okay, not just knowledge. So that's the distinction there. In the servo mechanical area, you can see some of those infrastructure we are dealing with. For example, there are more than 600,000 bridges in America, and most of them are not in good shape. The pipelines, two million miles, natural gas lines, commercial aircraft, 9,000 of that in America alone, and the wind turbines, which we are turning more attention into, as well as nuclear engineering and renewable resources, solar energy, and so on. This is a very provoking slide. It's about healthcare. This is one of the major problems in our country. If you look at the y-axis is the dollar spending. The x-axis is the number of years, longevity, how long we live. So this is one of the indicators of how good is your healthcare. If you look at America, so we are somewhere here. Do you see the arrow there? Yeah, you can see it. We are one of the highest, but our longevity is only less than 78. Okay. Look at some other countries. Japan. They spend about less than one third of what we spend, and their lifespan is about 82 years. All right. So you can see that there's a lot of stuff we can do. So as much what we are talking today, like the nanotechnology, biotechnology, and of course the different systems, healthcare, insurance, and Medicare, things like that. There are also systematic problems. But this gives you a very good idea how we stand among the world's advanced nations. This is taken from the Harvard Business Review in April of this year. Now, let's talk about translational research. Usually, it's interdisciplinary. It covers many different disciplines. And with my tenure at NSF, I usually discover, and we usually discover, that the most discoveries are at the interfaces of different disciplines. Can you all hear me at the back there? If not, sit in the front. There's still plenty of seats. Okay. So usually it involves a team. I think that you guys have many different teams and relies on partnerships with industry, with people like Boeing or other agencies or other universities or other departments, so partnerships. And it usually results in a clear benefit to the society. So that is very much in line with the second criteria of the NSF review criteria, the broader impact. Now, the translational research is nothing new in the medical profession. This is one of those centers which was established in close to Washington, D.C., a couple, maybe 20 years ago. So the medical industry always look at translational research. That is, how they can translate the medical findings into actual practice to better the healthcare of the people. Now, this is what is called Pasteur's quadrant. I think many of you have seen that before, and I modified that a little bit. In the y-axis, we are talking about the fundamental understanding. That is the depth of fundamental research. On the x-axis is how good is it to the society, the application aspects. All right? So somewhere here, this is the best part. That is, it has a lot of intellectual challenges, but also a lot of applications. So over here, we listed Louis Pasteur as one of them. That is the Pasteur's quadrant. He's the one who did this pasteurization, if you recall. All the milk you drink, okay, they are pasteurized. He's one of those pioneers in the biochemistry area. So his work is very basic, but at the same time used a lot. And I added this term here, translational research. And it's usually multidisciplinary, and it's also intellectually challenging, but also has a lot of applications. So I listed Rick Smalley and Gao, who got the Nobel Prize last year in the optical fiber. And I think my friend Professor Pipes and CT would also be in this category. And some of you, your researchers too. This is in the translational research. That is what you're doing is very challenging and at the same time very useful to the society. And over here is Bohr, Bohr is the nuclear physicist. His stuff is pretty basic, but it's not much application yet in this case. And you all know Edison, Thomas Edison. Actually, in the basic sense, his theories are not too deep, okay? It's very, very basic, very fundamental knowledge. But that has a lot of applications, okay? So that's Thomas Edison's area. And somewhere here, I didn't put any name there because that might offend some people. Those are the ones that is not too intellectually challenging and not much application. All right. So those are what we call incremental applied research. Okay. And this is the strategy, for innovation. At the bottom, we like to have a very good foundation in education. Okay. Education is the foundation. And then over here in the middle part, we like to promote entrepreneurship and partnership. And up here in the top part of the pyramid, these are all the basic breakthroughs, clean energy, advanced vehicle technology, information technology, and grand challenges. That is the National Academy's 14 grand challenges and so on. Now, these are some of the examples, looking backwards, some of the things that National Science Foundation have been doing, which are truly transformative. In the 50s, we supported the computer-aided design, and I think now everybody is kind of using it, computer-aided design, computer-aided manufacturing. And later, we supported MEMS. Now, we are doing more in the NEMS area, the nano electromechanical systems. Fiber optics was also started by us, as well as tissue engineering, Doppler radar, the internet, which is one of our success stories. You might hear that Vice President Gore said he discovered that. But actually, it was supported by NSF and Doppler about 35 years ago. We built the university backbone, and then later it forms the basis of the e-commerce and the World Wide Web and so on. How many of you do not use the internet here? See? So this is what we call translational. Okay. It makes a lot of difference in the way you're learning, in the quality of your life. Then we are also, our division actually supported the MRI, the magnetic resonance imaging, and Paul Lederberg is the one that got the Nobel Prize. Later, we also supported thin films, that is what is being used in the information technology now, computer chips, electronic materials. And this is an overall success story. We supported 187 Nobel laureates so far before they get the Nobel Prizes. Okay, after they got it, it's very easy for them to get an award. So these are before they get the Nobel Prizes. And some of the programs at the National Science Foundation that is supportive of translational research, I think you can read it, like the centers, STC, ERC, NSET, MERSET, and the GOLI program, which is the one has strong industrial component, and IUCRC, the PFI, SBIR, STTR, NIRT. I was heavily involved in that, NIRT. That's the team project for the nano. And Right now, we have the EFRI. Every year, we put in about $20 million to support new ideas and other programs. Now, I think you might have seen this before. These are some of the resources we invested. This is the different stages of development. The basic research is the one that NSF supports, mostly here. And then we also have some SBIR programs, the one that I just showed. And somewhere here is the production, commercialization. And from here to here, this is called the valley of death. Okay. A lot of good ideas die in this valley of death. So we like to push this envelope a little bit more towards the right. So this is called translational research. And these are some of the examples for nanoscience and engineering that we are using. And I discussed this a little bit before. These are some examples, like this intelligent smart glass, which could prevent ultraviolet light and keep your vehicle cool, things like that. And this is by the Secretary of DOE, Energy. He mentioned that if you just make your roofs lighter, your pavement brighter color, it will save millions of barrels of oil. Okay. And this is some of the quantities. Just 100 square meters of a white roof. Okay. About 1,000 square feet. Replacing a dark roof. Usually we have a black roof or asphalt. This will offset the emission about 10 tons of carbon dioxide. Okay. So it's a very green technology. So you can see that some of these roofs, they look good too. Okay. They are more bright and, it will cut down on your air conditioning and other, energy uses. Let's now talk about nanoscience and engineering. I think everybody knows the definition is any dimensions below 100 nanometers. This slide is from Mirocco, one of my colleagues. That's the definition of this nanotechnology. And this is the benefits of investing in nanotechnology. Right now, we spend about $1.6 billion, all agencies, about 25 or so. Federal agencies spend that much money. And about 1.9 billion from industry. And with this input, we can produce 140,000 new jobs and $70 billion of products, $14 billion of taxes, and so on. So this is the pipeline of the R&D. This is an estimate on the worldwide market of nanotechnology. It's still pretty much on track. I remember Mirocco put out this estimate, $1 trillion by 2015, about 5 years ago. And I think the data points are still pretty good. Okay. So you can see that right now it's about $80 billion, in the US, more than that now, close to here, about 90 or more. These are some of our success stories, as I mentioned before. MRI is one of them. And this one here is the data storage system at the Carnegie Mellon University. Over here, Chuck Merkin from Northwestern University on nanopatterning and detection technologies. And this particular one just appeared about last month, I believe. It's about graphene. Over here, there are principal investigators, Batsell and Olinick from University of South Florida. They are putting two graphenes together, two sheets of graphene, and in the middle, they introduce the defect. And these are the metallic, these are the defects about several atoms wide, and they create this metallic interconnect. And with that, you could have much smaller chips. As you know, the Moore's law is approaching a limit. And right now we are roughly about maybe 50 nanometers or a little bit smaller. But if you want to extend the Moore's law, something like this may do it. Here is about the repulsive force that's actually observed experimentally. Okay. Over here is done at Harvard University. Capasso is the principal investigator. And he observed that this gold-coated spear in this silicon plate experienced this repulsive force, which is really tiny, 10 billionth of a newton. This is an interesting one. I think everybody seems to think that carbon nanotubes are invincible, but they're also an Achilles pawn for the carbon nanotube. And this is what the author has discovered. This is Professor Chang from Shanghai University. If you look at this, like this is a carbon nanotube. If you kind of pinch on it, okay, pinch on this carbon nanotube, then the whole thing will collapse, okay? And in the process of that, they will shoot something out too. So this is what he discovered. Over here, he's looking at the propagation speed and also the tube diameter. And the next one, he's looking at the speed of this particle inside the carbon nanotube. If you pinch on it, this particle will travel about 1.5 or so kilometers per second. Over here, he's putting down 1 kilometer per second. As you know, the rifle's bullet is about 0.7, so it's faster than the rifle. And this could be used as an energy provider in the NEMS area or as some kind of a control. This is pretty new, almost brand new. It's from on the nanofabrics. You all recognize the all-time Olympian, Michael Phelps. Michael got how many gold medals he has? 9, is it? 8 or 9, right? All-time high. Well, anyway, he was wearing these nanofabrics, okay? These nanofabrics has the surface, which is similar to the shark skin, okay? Kind of V-groove type of shape. And it has 20% less drag and much more buoyancy. And it dries instantly. And so he won that with this superior swimming suit. Right now, this is now banned in Olympics now. Okay, but he got the record. Okay, but if you're not competing in Olympics, you can wear that anytime. All right. Then there are many other uses. Over here, you can see that this fabric repels water. Okay, that's done in the Zurich. University of Zurich, and you can see that the water is being repelled by these nanoscale filaments. And also phase change materials. They can also be used as sensors in the fabric. You have sensors to detect your vital signs, whether the soldier is injured, whether he has some kind of disease or whatever. So those can be used. And it's also lightweight. You can also build insect repellent into it. Okay, so if you're in the Amazons or a place like that, you don't worry about the mosquitoes. And this will also be wicking. That means it can breathe. Okay, so the sweat can get out of your body, and you will feel pretty cool by wearing this kind of fabric. It also can do the other way to block the sunlight. Okay, the ultraviolet light. So this is another use of it, nanorods. The graphene is another one, which we think will have a lot of potential. It's a material which is just one atom thick of carbon atoms. In the beginning, the manufacture of this is very interesting. It's what is called the Scottish tape method. So what do? They put specks of graphite on a Scotch tape, okay, and then put Scotch tape on top of it, and then just peel it out. Then maybe half of it will be on one side. And then they will put another Scotch tape on it and peel it again. Maybe one quarter will be there. Okay. Then we'll put another Scotch tape on it and peel it. And maybe one eighth will be there. Okay. They do it N times finally, they come up with about one atom thick carbon. This is called the Scotch tape method. Okay. So that is a very brute force to manufacture, graphene. But now there are better ways to do it. The so-called Princeton method, is Professor Ihan Aksai. Is one of the PIs that I happen to support him, actually. He got one of the NERD proposals. And he used oxidized graphite and coats with hydroxide epoxy groups. And he's successful in getting a surface area of about 1,700 square meter per gram, okay, per gram of material. You can imagine how thin it is, okay. This is 1,700 square meters. Okay, what is the size of this room? This room is probably about 20 square meters, right? Or maybe 30 square meters. All right, so that gives you a size. And this also, graphene has also some useful properties. Transports electron at top speed with little scattering. So this is good in the information technology area, computers, and also into the wireless communications. Transistors in the terahertz range, okay, and nanoelectronic devices, flexible displays, and functionalized materials, okay. So this graphene is the next wonder material. We usually think that carbon nanotube has a lot of good stuff, but now I think graphene may be one of the things that offers a lot of potential. This is one of the transistors based IBM simulation. And the graphene is this bottom, the chicken wire type of material here. And the gray pipe is the electrode, the gate electrode, these two here. And the drain electrode are the brown ones. Okay, so this is a simulated graphene transistor. Now, next, let's talk a little bit about clean energy. This is about nanophotosynthesis. And there are many different places that's doing it. This particular one is in Lausanne in Switzerland. And other places like University of Arizona and Berkeley and other, they are doing something along these lines. That's looking into how the plants, the leaves, how to take the sunlight. And then they break this carbon dioxide into oxygen and then protein and other products. Okay. So it's that process. And we like to learn from them. What kind of efficiency they have? How do they do it? This is one of such efforts. And, this just appeared, in the Chemical and Engineering News. I think it's about a week ago. Okay. Over here, they are combining this P3HT. This is one of the chain, polymer chain, combine that with the fullerene derivative into this material, this composite type of material. And this will promote the migration of the electrodes when it is under the solar heat. So over the next slide, you will see how it works. So when the light travels through this material, it goes through the protective coating, the transparent electrode, the transport layer. This is the layer where this, the positive and negative charges are migrated to different electrodes and form the circuit. So this is how this, this is called the organic photovoltaics, works. Okay. Organic photovoltaics. And right now, we're looking at three different things, major initiatives, signature initiatives. NNI stands for the National Nano Initiative. Nanoelectronics is one of them. Nano manufacturing and nano solar. Okay. Those are the three, electronics, manufacturing, the energy, solar. This is furnished by my colleague, Mike Rocco. Some of the priority research areas. One of them is the integration of nanotechnology in these application areas. We have been using electron charge as the information carrier for decades. Now we'd like to find out what are some other ways to do it, some more efficient ways to do it. Then we have energy, water resources, nanomanufacturing, sustainable environment. This is one keyword which has been used again and again, sustainability. And the nanobio interface, which is part of my talk, and the nanoinformatics. Some other transdisciplinary domains. One of them is the quantum information science, the eco-bio complexity. This covers bio, nano, and system approach. And then we have the neuromorphic engineering, combined nano-bio information technology, neurosciences, cyber-physical systems, okay, synthetic biology. So these are some of the converging technologies. These are some of the industrial contribution to the centers, okay, the NCN and the NNIN. This is the nano computational network. And I think you are intimately related to that. Over here, we have 37 NANSECs. That's the Nano Science and Engineering Center. They have about 400 partners, providing about $42 million of industrial support, and the total support from other organizations, about 280. Okay, so those are some of the statistics. This is about education. I helped to establish the Summer Institute on Nanomechanics and Nanomaterials about 9 years ago. Okay. And Professor Liu was the first, the initial founding director. Now is Professor Chong and also Professor Berlisco and, Chao and Liu as the co-directors. So this Summer Institute has two sessions, and you are all welcome to participate if you want. They have fellowships to give out on a competitive basis. And each session will be about three quarter hours of credit. Okay, so it's very intensive. And they talk about different types of topics in the nano and the bio area, mechanics. Now, this is looking into the bigger picture. And before 2000, year 2000, we were looking into the passive nanostructures. Okay? We always look into characterization, what are the properties, and so on. Later, we evolved in the active nanostructures, and then into system nanosystems. And currently, we're looking more into molecular nanosystems. This is the fourth generation. All right. Then later, as I mentioned the previous slide, converging technologies. So this is the roadmap, if you will, of the nanotechnology prototyping and commercialization. And over here, this is the composite material. I know that my friend Byron is here, so this is about composites. It kind of demonstrates quite drastically what composites can do, even though this is not a nano composite. This is an ice cube or ice disk without any reinforcement. If you drop it on a hard floor, it will just broken down, something like this. Okay? Now, if you just put some even newspapers, okay, and then let it freeze, and then you drop it, see, not much happened to it. So that's the power of the composite, okay? So you can see quite drastically. And the next few slides shows you some of the pioneers in the nano science and technology engineering, except yours truly. I just happened to be there, okay? So this particular one is Greg Benick. I visited him about 7 years ago at Zurich, IBM Zurich. He was the one, I think, most responsible for the nano science and engineering. In 1986, he got the Nobel Prize for the scanning tunnel microscope together with Henry Rogner. Okay. And starting with the scanning tunnel microscope, we can see and manipulate the molecules. Okay. That pretty much started the nanoscience and engineering. So he's one of the pioneers in nanoscience and engineering. This particular one, of course, is Rex Molley. And I think the discovery of the buckyball and later this is a carbon 60 I'm talking about. Buckyball and then the carbon nanotubes and now the graphenes. So all started with this discovery. And I talked to him around 2004. He said the most challenging area, the next few decades, would be the integrating wet and dry materials. What's the meaning of that? The wet materials, you can say that those are biological materials, okay? The dry materials are the structural materials. So the interface between the bio and the solid materials are some of the most challenging areas. This one, I think most of you probably know him, Miroku. I would credit him with pushing this nanotechnology ahead. I remember back in 1990 or so, he started the nanoparticle program with $10 million. Okay. Later, because of his persistence and preservation, he convinced 20-some federal agencies to pitch in and become a White House initiative. And right now, the budget is about $1.6 billion. Okay. So starting from $10 million, this goes to $1.6 billion. All right. So that is his contribution. And I think not only that, he also had the vision to guide this program. Now, this is a system nanotechnology. And you can see that right now we are talking more about systems rather than components. So, the translational aspects, we're looking into new materials, faster computing, even into organ regeneration, sensors, energy. Okay, those are some of those wide applications. This is one of them. And this silicon nanowire, this will change if you have some of the proteins, disease proteins that come into binding with this functionalized wire, then the conductance will change. So you can detect the signature of that. And energy harvesting, piezoelectric materials, if you change the distance between these two plates, then you generate the potential and the electricity. Okay. So with that kind of principle, one can put this at the bottom of your shoes. Okay. In the sole of your shoes. When you're walking or jogging, then it will generate enough electricity to power your pacemaker or some other things. Okay. Or your iPod or whatever. Okay. So this is part of it. Energy harvesting. Also, you can also do a lot of harvesting with the waves too. And over here, there are some others, nano fountain probe. This is one which is used in the nano manufacturing and also sensing area. This one is interesting. It's not too new. It will appear in ASME 2001. Over here, we have the nano pores. And then inside the capsule, these are in millimeters type of size, so it can be swallowed. And what happened is that the nanopores will prevent the red blood cells from entering this capsule, but it will not prevent these drugs from going out at a certain rate. Okay, so that is a drug delivery system. And this one here has some applications into the batteries and other types of membranes where you would have some kind of self-cleaning surface. And over here is silicon nanowires. If you put the electricity through it, it will either be hydrophobic or hydrophilic. And those of you who play golf, you probably recognize this in our ANSET in Wisconsin, MERSEC. This is the formula, okay? But it's patented, so you can copy it if you like. They claim that you can hit the golf ball much further away and more accurately. And I actually have a demonstration of that with one of the surfaces, but it's hard to bring it to the airplane, so I didn't bring it with me. But you can see that the surface, which is amorphous, actually, this is an amorphous material. The bounce of the ball is much higher, and it will not be dissipated. The energy will be there a lot much longer. So the damping is very minimal. Some of the sensors area, some of the people that organized the workshop for us last year, Michael Rooks is one of them. And then we have some others from Oak Ridge and from the industry and California. Some other people, IIT, in the fabrication area, integration and the networking. Let's spend a few minutes on the bio side, okay? You may be surprised that there's so much soft material, collagen material in human body. The bones, the cartilages, the tendons, the nerves, the cells, okay? So all these pose very interesting mechanics problems. This is a similar thing compared with a building block that we are accustomed to, bricks and mortar. And this is exactly what's happening in the biological world. Okay? So we try starting from here all the way up into enzymes and some beta solenoids and so on. And the soft materials. Now we're talking about soft materials. The knee is actually a very complex structure. And we all can also talk about the drug delivery systems, contact lenses. All these are soft materials. In the mechanic sense, they have many uses, like soft robots, drug delivery systems, tissue engineering, water treatment, and the packers in oil wells. And it poses many challenging problems in mechanics, large deformation, mass transport, thermodynamic forces, modes of instability. And this is still pretty new field in the microfabrication area, nanofabrication, computational modeling, experiments, and bio-inspired materials, and so on. And the next thing we can learn is also from nature, from geological formations, biological systems, find out how do they evolve over the millions of years? How do they optimize themselves? So we'd like to see from them, to see how we can improve in the design of materials. This is about sensing. It's an interesting observation. You may recall that about 2 years ago, we have a tsunami, right, in Indonesia, and that killed many people and destroyed houses. But I think you don't see that any elephant got killed. Did anybody see any elephant got drowned? No? Well, what's the reason? Well, the elephant ear, this is the elephant's ear. They have some special sensors that can sense the tsunamis when they are hundreds of miles away. So they start running to the higher ground. Okay? And humans cannot do that. We don't have that kind of sensor. And right now we don't even have that kind of artificial sensor. So that is something we can learn from them. See how the elephants can detect the tsunami hundreds of miles away. Okay? And this particular one is some kind of a mouse in the desert. This is called a golden mole. Okay? Golden mole is real tiny. But it can detect water miles away. All right? So if you have that kind of sensor, maybe we can detect oil which is only 1 mile down or 2 miles down. Okay. So that is something we can learn from them. The biological systems. And I saw one of the slides that you guys have. This is particular one is using optical tracers to see the cells. And the bottom is the blood cell that was infected by malaria. And the top one is a healthy one. So if we try to pull this apart, the healthy one will have that kind of elasticity, as you can see. Okay. About the force is 151 piconewtons. On the other hand, the one infected with malaria, doesn't elongate at all. It's very hard. Okay. So this is some kind of, sensors we can develop to detect disease. And, the gecko is another one, which is fascinating. And you can see the gecko go up the wall and up the ceiling, and we cannot do it, right? How can they do it? So this particular project, which is supported by my program, is study in the nano sense, how does the gecko get that kind of adhesion? Okay. Not only the adhesion. You don't want to get stuck there forever, right? You want to release your foot sometime. So how does the gecko release their feet? That's also important. So he studied that kind of phenomenon. So this is what was discovered. If you try to pull these nanotubes in a perpendicular direction, it requires a lot of force to do it, okay? This is the one adhesive is easy. Oh, I'm sorry. I should say this one. If you try to pull it tangentially, it requires a lot of force. Okay. But if you try to pull it perpendicular to the surface, it's very negligible. So that's how the gecko release his feet. All right. Once he's up there, he wants to walk. So this is the way that the mechanism, and this is how he did it. If you look at this angle here, that stands for the gecko's feet. At the 0 degrees, that means this is the shear force, which is very high to get it apart. And 90 degrees means it's normal to it. Okay, so it's very easy to release it. Another one which is fascinating as a control mechanism is the fire. This is the fire trap plant. Okay. How many of you have seen this kind of plant? Fire trap plant. Okay. It's quite a lot of them in the subtropical area. Like Hong Kong, I have seen it. Okay. It's very interesting. I saw it at work, actually. This is the fly that got trapped. Okay. It's flying into to get the nectar, which smells good. So he go in and then it will collapse on him and then got digested. All right. But if you have a drop of water or dust going into that, it will not close. Okay. So it can distinguish that kind of thing. So over here is the control mechanism. How does it work? It works very robustly and also continuously. Now, about the spider web. There's actually 7 types of spider silk in a spider web. And some of the strongest one are this drag line, this kind of perimeter silk. And if you look at the properties, the drag line silk, the material strength is comparable to Kevlar, which is one of the strongest man-made material. But the elasticity is about, 7 times more, okay, 700% more than the Kevlar. So they absorb a lot of energy, a lot of impact. So if we built armor plate or clothing with this kind of material, it could be a bulletproof or prevent the roadside bomb from getting into the vehicle, things like that, okay? So it absorbs a lot of energy. And this is being built, done at also at MIT, studying the hierarchical structure of spider silk. And the skin, of course, is something we can also build with carbon nanotubes, okay, with a sensing element, and also they serve many different purposes, actually, to keep the germs out, regulate temperature, absorption of nutrients, and sensing. And another one which is of interest, just look at the melon. This is the the melon which we can characterize. You can see the pattern there on the surface of the melon. There are always certain kind of pattern. And the way we can learn from them, how do they grow that kind of pattern? There are only four different parameters. We can characterize them. This is the ratio of this elliptical melon, the long axis and the short axis, and the ratio, the thickness, the Young's moduli, and the stresses. Okay, those can characterize the formation of the surface of this melon. And based on that, we can study the stretchable electronics. The principle of this is quite simple. If you have a sheet of paper, let me borrow a sheet of paper from you. Let's imagine this is a substrate. Okay, this is a substrate. You pull on it first, and then you deposit a thin film on it. All the time, you maintain the tension. Okay. Then when the thin film start curing, you release the tension. What will happen? It will form that kind of wavy structure, right? This is similar to the stability problem, the wrinkling problem. Okay. So the principle is really simple. But to do it right in two-dimensionally requires some kind of mathematics and mechanics. So this is what the author is doing. Professor Yang Huang from Northwestern University. You can see that he's pulling this in two directions. Let me go into the next one. Yeah, this one here. See, this is the substrate that you start pulling, then you deposit the thin film, and then you release the force, and then it becomes wavy. Okay, those are the wrinkling type of trick of instability. So, based on that, you have this kind of shape. And from there, he can build many different things. One of them appeared in the cover of the Nature and in 2008. And this is the one that with two dimensions. And you can form a three-dimensional sensor, like the eye. Okay, the eye you can see peripherally. You don't not only see in the normal direction, but you can see what is on the side. So that is the electronic eye that he was building. And change gear a little bit, looking into some of the surfaces. This is the lotus, which has been studied a lot, but because the water will not stick to it, so we can study how to make self-cleaning surface, how to make this kind of hydrophobic and hydrophilic type of surfaces for catalysts and so on. This is taken from my textbook. This is the one in multi-scale modeling. I'm going through this rather quickly. This is towards the end of my talk now, so you will have a few minutes for questioning. Looking into the nanoscale, microscale, mesoscale, macroscale, and system level, these are some of the tools that's available. The y-axis is the strain resolution, and the x-axis is the gauge length. If you look at atomic force microscope, that is applicable in this range in here. And some others, like this neutron scattering, that not many places has it. This small angle, ultra small angle, those are applicable in this nanometer range up to the millimeter range. And different theories, different timescales, different experimental methods. This provided by Mark Shepard from RPI. So looking into ab initio, the first principles all the way up to the meter range. And this is from my colleague, James Lee, from George Washington University, looking into quantum mechanics, molecular dynamics, microcontinuum, classical continuum, and this, the time scale and the length scale. And this summarizes some of the application areas and limitations. Okay, so I will be quite brief on that because of the time. And first principles, it's most basic, but it's computational intensive. So because it's proportional to the number of orbitals to the fourth power. So consequently, we can only model thousands of atoms. And molecular dynamics is a little bit more, maybe millions of time steps, but it's also tedious. Model up to billions of atoms for nanoseconds. And there are some other methods combining, but they cannot take care of multiphysics problems yet. This is about the different scale again, looking from the biological phenomenon. And again, multi-scale problems. This is looking into the manufacturing aspects. On the top is the nanotechnology area. At the bottom is the biological systems, how different things are manufactured. Of interest is somewhere here. This is some of the critical scale, the mesoscale area. That kind of bridge from the nanoscale up to the macro and system level. This is one of the unique facility at NIST. This is to simulate about 22 suns, the ultraviolet light generated by 22 suns, 24 hours and 7 days a week. This is about a bridge, let's see. And to sum up, this is what one of our former director said, Dr. Rita Colwell, 11th director of NSF. She said nanoscale technology impact equal to the Industrial Revolution. And I think you all probably would agree with that. And some of the acknowledgments. And this is one of the papers that I wrote some years ago, 2004, a review paper. And some others that's available on the web. 10-year vision. And these are mostly put out by NNI. This is a new journal, which I'm one of the editors. So you're welcome to send papers to us. Okay, so I will just try to make you aware of that. This is about smart and nanomaterials, published by Taylor and Francis. And another journal I'm editing. These also have something like the carbon nanotubes in the thin wall structures. And some of you from the aerospace, most aerospace structures are thin wall composite materials. So you're welcome, again, to send papers to me, because I know this appear in NanoHub, so I try to have a minute of commercial here. And another one, book series I'm editing. And I'd like to thank you for your attention. This is pretty much like a fire hose, so I'm trying to put as much information for you as it is.
Yeah, I have a very sort of educational question. Since the nanotechnology and neuroscience sort of accepted by the engineering community, at the nanoscale, what do you think is the difference between science and engineering?
Actually, it's very fuzzy. I think a lot of schools, they call it instead of College of Engineering, they pretty much call it College of Applied Science or something like that.
Some universities. Which one?
I think Princeton may be one of them. Is that right, Byron? Applied Science. I think Applied Science is there. School of Engineering and Applied Science. So it's a very fussy area, especially in engineering science. People in mechanics, like us, it's very mathematical. And so even at the National Science Foundation, I work with the people in the Mathematical and Physical Sciences Directorate a lot. They have a mathematics division, and sometimes we co-sponsor projects, sometimes we co-review them, you know. So I think the boundary is getting more and more fuzzy.
I saw when you were doing this nanotechnology roadmap for the answer, started with the nanostructures in 2000, and then every 2 years it kept changing the focus. So the translation is very fast. This time domain is 2 years. Mm-hmm. How is it changing focus so fast? Is it difficult to achieve a realistic result in 2 years?
Yeah, I was part of my ROCOS team before. And what we did, I think Mike conveyed a lot of workshops. Okay? And he also has to be responsible for the different types of vision, different progress, and to be accountable to Congress. Okay. So I think the roadmap that I have shown you actually is for about 25 years or so, right? Starting from 1990 all the way up to about 2020. So it's about 30 years. So.
That's probably they're talking about the wrong slide. There was a slide which in 2004 there was system of systems. And right now, the focus is on translation. Every 2 years, there was a change.
Translation is not the one they focus. It's what I presented. Okay? I don't think they put the word translation there in the nano, in the NNI, right? I don't think so. But my talk, which is solely my own responsibility, is to talk about translational research in this particular seminar. Okay, so it's nothing to do with the NNI. Okay, I'm not representing NNI.
Oh, you showed that the biosensors, that the elephants have those ear sensors or the smog meter you're talking about, and golden mole and the gecko. How did we find out about them though? If we don't have them, how do we test? How do we find out that these guys have it? Like the elephant has this, how did we come up? Who came up with it and like said, okay, these guys have these sensors inside to prevent them from drowning or whatever?
That's what's called discovery. Okay.
Right.
Yeah, it's something you have to observe, something you have to read really widely. Sometimes you have to think out of the box a little bit, you know. So all these things is what I mentioned, different disciplines kind of interact with each other, and in the process of that, they enrich each other, okay? So I think it's not something you can just sit in your office and daydream, okay? So you have to actually read a lot of stuff, interact with your colleagues, and be observing of different kind of phenomenon, okay? Yeah.
Isaac, I noticed with all the, the energy harvesting, maybe in shoe and all that stuff, and I was thinking, what's the life expectancy? Like, do these things self-generate, or, like, when they do, like, if they wind up not working anymore, like, what kind of measures should be done to throw it away? Because there's, a lot of, hazardous materials, these type of programs, and, you have to know how to, throw those out, so... I was just wondering how you deal with these
materials. I think there are many tools now that's available to you. In the past, we are always given a material and then we want to study, characterize them, study their properties, right? That's one thing we like to do. But now we do it differently. We come up with a set of specifications, what we like this material to do. And then we start from the molecules and then try to see how do we make the material to fit that kind of specifications. Okay. So it's doing the other way. And again, it's part of the research process.
As I ask last question,
okay.
A practical issue. I have some nanowires from carbon nanowires. They make bigger wires.
Mm-hmm.
So trying to make a fiber, practical fiber, and we call them.
Right.
Before we do that, there's a material safety sheet.
Uh-huh.
That sheet made our building representative nuts.
Uh-huh.
Because we have no filter system that can ever catch those little fibers.
Right, right.
And if it's getting the body, what's going to happen?
Right.
Nobody knows how to handle those situations. If that's something you come to a building that really is involved, we cannot do it.
Yeah. Good question. I actually didn't put in one of the slides that Mike Rocco gave me. It's talking about environmental and health and safety. Okay. We spend about 1/6 of our resources in the nano science and engineering into environment, health and safety. So we have, I think we have a couple of centers. You can visit them and see they're trying to set some kind of rules, some kind of protocols that would safeguard the researcher and the students. Okay.
Other questions? Thank you very much again.
Okay, thank you.